Shallow Graves, My Life as a Forensic Scientist on Britain's Biggest Cases, The Murder of Sarah Payne, Adam the Thames Torso, The London Bombings, The Night Stalker, and The Poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko. The solving of all these cases can be linked to one man, Ray Fish, a Charlton Athletic fan from Woolwich, a natural raconteur, and also one of the finest forensic detectives the country has ever seen. He's put all he's been through in his years of service in a new book called Shallow Graves. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, perhaps close to the Charlton Athletic ground itself. Ray Fish. Ray, good morning to you.
Yes, good morning, Charles.
Okay, where do we find you, by the way? Are you somewhere near the sacred grounds of Charlton Athletic?
Well, I was brought up in southeast London, near Woolwich, but I actually live in deepest Kent now.
Darkest, deepest Kent, indeed. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved then with the force. I'm presuming we're talking about the Metropolitan here. Metropolitan, please.
Yeah, 18, I basically needed a job. Saw an advert for the Forensic Science Laboratory, the Metropolitan Police Forensic Science Laboratory. Decided to apply along with other jobs and was fortunate enough to get offered a post there. Now, I was a young 18-year-old, new out of school with A-levels, thought I knew it all, soon realised I didn't, had to sort of study to get my degree and et cetera, et cetera. And it went from there and I fell into a job that I absolutely loved.
What was it about sort of forensics in those early days? I presume we're talking sort of mid-70s at that point?
Yeah, I joined in 1971, so I was 18 in 71. To be quite honest, I had no real interest in forensic science at 18. You know, I was more interested in football, beer, and girls. You know,
yeah, the normal stuff, yes, exactly.
Typical 18-year-old, but it soon fascinated me the way that the unravelling of puzzles and the problem-solving things sort of started to develop and everything. And it really, one of my first things was back in 71. I saw a number of police officers from Hertfordshire walk through the toxicology section, the drug and poison section of the laboratory where I worked, and they were discussing the case of Graham Young, the notorious teacup poisoner. And I thought, that is what I want to do. I want to be involved. I want to be on the inside of those sort of meetings, not on the outside looking in.
And, I mean, this is sort of, I mean, now we have, there's such a raft of resources that you can draw on. That it is an entire, it is a different country, it's a different time, as the saying goes. How has, if you like, forensics changed over the years? Because I believe, you know, these days it's more an integral part at the start of an investigation rather than just being something that's tagged on to the side of an investigation.
Yes, when I joined forensic science was seen by detectives as very much a corroboration tool. And what I mean by that is an offence is committed, police will then do the investigation, identify a suspect, and it's then that forensics will be used to either corroborate or evaluate, you know, the hypothesis of the police officer, decide whether or not there's evidence there to support their hypothesis that offender did it. Today, what I wanted to do, and it was when I got the job of specialist advisor in 1996, a job that came out of the investigation into the failings of the Yorkshire Ripper inquiry, which said that a senior scientist should be involved attached to these inquiries. And it was then I decided that really forensic science should not only be used as a corroboration tool, but it should be used in the investigative phase as well, which meant getting in right in at day one of the inquiry.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned sort of the Yorkshire Ripper case, because, I mean, I was a child, I think I was about 10, 11 years old, when, you know, Peter Sutcliffe had this reign of terror on the Midlands and the North. And it's difficult to explain to somebody who's, you know, who doesn't know about it or was born later, about how terrifying that was for women throughout the country, because, you know, this is an age, you know, before mobile phones, before social networks, and women were afraid.
In that time, there was no things such as social networks. There wasn't things such as CCTV, which we take for granted these days. Phone records, mobile phone records, there were none of that. AMPR, automatic number plate recognition, all dash cam footage, all of the stuff that police will appeal for today, none of that was around. Therefore, the only way the police could sort of try and get a preventative sort of strategy together was basically to tell women not to go out at night, which is really shouldn't be right. You know, there should be some protection for these women.
What was the reaction then from, if you like, the more traditional police officers, you know, who had done sort of their thing, the things their way since the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, if they said that, you know, that an SA should get involved or a forensic should get involved from the very beginning of the case? You must have run up against some walls. You must have rubbed up somebody's back.
Yes. You don't go through a career of 50 years without sort of getting into confrontational sort of situations. My first one was really when I got my degree. I got my degree from the old style polytechnics. Day release, night school, spent 7 years getting a degree. And then from then I jumped up from what was known as an assistant, so I was doing work for other people, to an actual case reporting officer where I would actually go to court and give the evidence. And there was a lot of thing around the sort of so-called people that had been to sort of recognised universities, the Oxfords, the Cambridges, etc. Didn't think that a person with a polytechnic degree should hold such a role. So that was really the first thing. And when I moved on to the specialist advisor, I was asking scientists to do something that was unusual to them. It wasn't standard technique. And, you know, that sort of rubbed scientists up, some of them, up the wrong way.
So imagine, I mean, just talk me through, if you can. I mean, a crime has been committed. I mean, obviously, if forensic is getting involved, it's obviously a very serious crime. Are you, from that point, were you literally one of the first people to be there, or one of the first people allowed within, I'm saying, again, this is completely layman, so bear with me, Ray, within sort of a cordoned off area?
Yeah, you know, it's mainly I would go into the incident room where the major decisions and speak to the senior investigating officer in the investigation team, advise them on what forensic science could do for their thing. And the simple way is basically get a briefing from them, exactly what they got. I may visit the scene as an advisor, but then you would sort of start to develop hypotheses. From those hypotheses, what exhibits have you got either to corroborate or, you know, take out those hypotheses? So you sort of build it from there. And it's really answering the questions the investigators want to know. You know, what do you want to know from forensic science? What are your problems? Are you struggling to link a person with another person, a person with a scene to scene? Are you trying to, what exhibits have we got that could possibly make those links for you?
And how difficult was it to sort of, I suppose the words they would say is maintain the integrity of either a scene or item, to make sure that they didn't get, you know, they didn't get tampered with either inadvertently or, you know, because somebody had picked it up at the wrong time sort of thing. That must have been, was that a sort of trial and error from the early days? And yeah.
No, there are standard procedures. A forensic scientist is built up with anti-contamination procedures and continuity. Continuity is being the trail of a thing from an exhibit, from a scene to the courtroom. So you ensure that the evidence you give around, the scientific evidence you give around that exhibit reflects that which was at the scene and everything. One thing I will say is scientists that get involved who are not trained forensic scientists are not brought up with these things. And it was there that sometimes I had to hold other scientists' hands and take them through exactly what was allowed, exactly what they needed to do.
What would you say was the first, in your experience, the first success, you know, the real success where you went, gotcha? Or we can explain this, you know, more easily. You know, what was the first time that, in your experience, that, you know, your forensic evidence made that difference?
Well, supposedly there was a couple of earlier ones beforehand, but the one major one was the murder of Sarah Payne. Sarah Payne was a six-year-old girl visiting her grandparents in East Sussex near Littlehampton. She went missing on a Saturday night and, first of all, treated as a missing person. 2 weeks later, her body was found some 20 miles away. But a day after her disappearance, a known paedophile was arrested by the name of Roy Whiting. Roy Whiting had in his possession, which he hadn't registered, was a white Ducati van. This had been bought from a sort of friend of his about a week ago and contained all the detritus that the old owner left in there. But brothers and sisters of Sarah were saying was that she was picked up and abducted in a white van. Whiting owned that van. Our job as a forensic scientist were to try and put Sarah Payne in that van. Now, it took over sort of 6 months, but first of all, we found fibres that linked Sarah Payne's clothing to items inside the van, and eventually we found a hair on a red sweatshirt, and the DNA profile matched that of Sarah Payne. Now, that put Sarah Payne in that van, and that was one of the first times that we really said, well, we've done it. But it took a long time.
How do you, because that is a case that, I'm just remembering it now, and that is a case that absolutely appalled the nation. And, you know, it was a beautiful day in, you know, a beautiful part of the country, and for this horror to be visited on that little girl. How do you sort of, if you like, switch off? Because you must have found stuff, you know, going through stuff there that must have, most of us would have, you know, would have nightmares about, or, you know, have shivers about, or not be able to block out. How did you manage to, and all the media that was going on, you know, Sarah's Law, etc., which we now have, is it difficult for you to, or is it your training, just to get on with the job?
I think it affected everybody, the investigating officers, to the scientists, to everybody. But we're trained professional people, and that is what we're paid to do. We are paid to get on with the job and get the evidence that is required, you know, if it's present, to retrieve that evidence, analyse that evidence, and eventually put that evidence before the court so the court could decide whether or not the person charged is guilty or not.
Also, you were involved with one of the most notorious cases, and one that had people scratching their heads for a very long time, because at the beginning, nobody could work out why the Russian dissident, Alexander Litvinenko, was how he was poisoned, why he was poisoned, what was happening to him.
This was I first got a call about this case on a Saturday morning from a contact I knew in the counterterrorism team. And basically, he knew I grew up as a toxicologist, basically. Before I got the role as special advisor, I was a toxicologist, so expert on poisons. He said to me, what do you know about thallium poisoning? I said, well, try me. I know a fair amount. And thallium was the material that Graham Young had used all those years beforehand. He said, well, we've got a Russian dissident in hospital. He's very seriously ill. He suffered, first of all, from abdominal pains, vomiting, nausea, diarrhea. His hair has started falling out after about 2 weeks. I said, well, yeah, that could well be thallium poisoning. Then he went on and said, well, there's other issues. He's also, he's got bone marrow problems with, and his blood cell count is all over the place. I said, well, that doesn't seem to be thallium poisoning. What are the levels have you got in urine? A urine sample had been taken and analysed at the poison unit. And when he read out the levels, I said, they don't seem that high to me. They're slightly above normal, but you can get that from eating seafood. And we knew Litvinenko basically was a lover of sushi. So I said, they could explain those levels. So we quickly arranged an urgent meeting of the following day in the lab, and along with other experts, one by the name of Dr. Nick Jent, who's a wonderful man, an expert from Public Health England. He attended when we went through it all. He actually came up with this brainwave an idea. Hold on, this sounds like somebody that's undergone radiotherapy. Have we tested for radioactive compounds? No, we hadn't. A urine sample was obtained, sent to AWE. Lo and behold, 24 hours later, we got the result back, polonium-210. So it's a big then scrabble for the textbooks and everything, because everybody'd sort of forgotten polonium-210 since their degree days. And that is how Litvinenko unraveled. Further work went on and showed that, in fact, there was two attempts at, or another attempt at poisoning him some weeks beforehand. It's an amazing case. It's totally different from the majority of forensic work.
Yeah, and it must have made you scratch your heads, because that opened up a whole sort of international incident over that, didn't it? Of, you know, where it came from, who could have got that poison, etc. I mean, there are some cases that you really do open the proverbial Pandora's box with what you find.
Yes, you do, but it's our job to put the evidence there. It's for the investigating officers then to follow that evidence up and everything. And I know one officer actually interviewed Litvinenko on his deathbed and basically got the story about Putin and et cetera, et cetera. And I knew this officer well, and he said to me later, said, it's the only time I've interviewed a murder victim.
Yeah, I mean, I just had a little WhatsApp from one of the listeners, Jason, good morning, who said he knew he was dying. He must have taken much courage and dignity to do that interview.
It's the iconic picture you see of Litvinenko on his bed with the loss of hair and everything. You know, basically, as soon as that poison went into him, when he drank that tea with that poison in, there was nothing anybody could do for him. Mm. He was dead from that point on.
Moving away from that, we talk about the cases where there's been a crime committed, but you worked on the London bombings, and was it the bombings of 27, or the attempted bombings? Because everybody knows about 7/7, but you worked on the bombings that failed. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I worked on both sets of bombings, 7/7 and 21/7. 7/7 were basically quite simple. In previous days of terrorism, where you had the IRA sort of suspects made every effort not to get themselves identified. And they were forensically aware, and it was hard for the forensic scientists that worked on those cases. However, with the suicide bombers, things changed. They were looking for martyrdom. They didn't hide their identity at all. So the identification, 7/7 bombers, was fairly straightforward. Also, the location of the bomb factory up in Leeds was identified quickly, and that all sort of thing. Then we had the 21/7 bombings. Now, these devices failed to fully detonate. The initial detonator went off, but it didn't explode the main charge. And again, we worked through for several months on this, identified, linked the suspects to the various scenes, linked them to the bomb factory. And I thought everything was going swimmingly on this when I got called to a meeting in middle of December at Scotland Yard, which contained the investigating officers, all the counsel for the prosecution, the forensic management team from counterterrorism team, and also the forensic explosives laboratory people and myself. When the lead counsel, Nigel Sweeney, asked the forensic explosives laboratory exactly what the main charge or what the device was consisted of, and they couldn't answer this question. Now, that sent shudders through everybody at that meeting, because they were being charged with conspiracy to murder. That needed to, in order to prove that charge, we needed to know the exact composition of the devices that they were trying to explode, to see whether or not they were viable enough. So I came out of that meeting with one task, and one task only: identify the composition of those viable devices. Now, we didn't deal with explosives. That was the thing at the Forensic Explosives Laboratory. But they didn't have the methods or that to deal with these explosives. So after that, I had to think aside and used contacts I had to eventually we got down to identifying the main composition of the devices and hence put the evidence before the court.
And then, of course, it was wasn't the case that they were saying, oh, well, they didn't really mean it. They were just going to let off flower bombs. That was one of the defense.
We knew their defense. One of them had managed to escape to Italy, and he was fighting extradition. And part of his fight of extradition, he gave this account that was the bombs were never meant to go off as an explosive. All they were supposed to do is do a big puff of flour in the air. Everybody would get covered in flour and everybody would walk away laughing. Now, you know, we plainly knew that that was untrue, you know, but we had to prove the exact composition of those devices.
Why did you decide to put this all down in a book now, Ray? What was the catalyst for writing the book?
The catalyst really, and I'll be honest here, is I met a couple of people, Emma Shaw, who's a TV director, producer, and James Nally. James Nally's a writer, TV producer and director. He did the programme Murder in the Car Park, if you remember that, the one of the special investigator that was killed in the pub car park. And we were looking to do some podcasts together, when eventually they came up and said, have you written a book? And I said, well, no, because I wouldn't have the ability to actually write a book. But James Nally did. So we sat down over 2 years and got this book together.
What would you say was what gave you the biggest sense of, I'm doing a job, and I know it's a job that's important, but I'm glad I do this job because I've made a difference?
I think one of the cases we haven't discussed yet, but really brought home the role, I thought, the specialist advisor, was as Adam, the torso in the Thames. Now, this was a little young torso of a black child found in the River Thames, September 2001. And basically, there was nobody coming forward. Police couldn't identify him. There was no missing persons reports related to him. And basically, we went. And I was given up in the January of the following year a task by Commander Baker, who was the head of Scotland Yard's homicide investigation team, basically find out as much about that boy as I could from science. And what we did, cut a long story short, we did a lot of work, but we managed to put him back from the River Thames in 2001. So the following year, we managed to get his place of birth and where he was brought up to Benin City in Nigeria through various analytical techniques. And I think that gave me the greatest sort of pleasure scientifically, because we went from nothing. We used techniques that had never been used in forensic science before, techniques that a lot of academics were saying won't work, but we, you know, got them to work, and that gave me the great pleasure.
The book is called Shallow Graves. It's by Ray Fish, who we've been speaking to today. Ray, if people want to find out more about the book or about yourself, is there a website? Do you do the social media thing?
I suggest they get onto the Bonnier Books website and find out about the book. I personally don't do social media. I'm afraid I'm of an age where, you know, I'm past, you know, I'm not that sort of a thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, Bonnier Books, they can...
And it will be available as a virtual download from our own bookstore. Only one more question, very important. So, Charlton, what are your hopes for the season, Ray?
Oh, I think after the last few years we've had, if we get playoffs, I'll be happy. It started okay, but we did beat Gillingham 3-0 last night, so, which is always a good thing.
I thought you sounded in a good mood when I phoned you this morning, but this book is called Shallow Graves. It's by Ray Fish. Ray, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you, Giles. Thanks for having me.